Begin.
Hey, what's up, guys, and welcome back to another episode of the Social Primate Podcast. Real quick, this is one of the last episodes for 2021, and as we're reaching that milestone, you know, as we're reaching the end of the year, I just kind of want to say thank you to all of you, because this year the podcast has seen an exponential growth that I honestly couldn't have imagined like a year or two ago. So it's cool to see that people are trusting me enough to entertain them, to inform them, to provide a different perspective, I don't know, in anything. And to me, that's awesome because it shows that people are curious. It shows that people are willing to consume information that may not be coming from a conventional source and just rolling with it. That to me is awesome. And I am glad that you guys chose Social Primate and you're choosing it right now to hear me out, to just learn a little bit of something and do what you please with it, you know? So thank you. I hope this keeps happening. Of course, it's always good to congratulate yourself on your efforts. And that's something that I want to do for myself too, because this is a one-man show. Social Primate is only ran by one person. Everything you see, everything that's put together, it's really just me behind all of this. So, you know, if you're in a project and you're the only one or you have somebody else helping you, just make sure you stop every now and then and congratulate yourself and just pat yourself on the back, because, again, this takes effort. This takes a lot of mental, physical, financial effort sometimes. And, you know, at one point or another, you're like overwhelmed with, should I keep going? Should I not keep going? And trust me, those are questions that I have myself. So thank you again. I hope you guys enjoy this conversation, and I hope you guys continue to enjoy the episodes coming out. 2022 and beyond. So, gracias a todos. Thank you for everybody. Let's get this started. Today's episode is with Matt Cedillo. He is a Chicano poet, writer, and author of Mowing Leaves of Grass and his forthcoming book, City on the Second Floor. Now, Matt is a very interesting character. The reason I wanted to have him on here was because I wanted to discuss a little bit something called critical race theory. Now, I know that wherever you stand on this, whether you're on the left or the right, you're going to have your pros and cons. This conversation is not for me to help you decide what you think is right or wrong. It's just to provide a background, some context into why this should be an important issue and why I think it's important that it should be taught, and not for the unconventional, like, racist ways that you people might think that you want to teach us for. It's at the end of the day, we have to know what has happened in our lifetime, not just mine, your ancestors, your grandparents, the history of the civilizations in which we stand, right? It's important to know that a lot of the things can be traced back to exploitation of certain groups of people. It can be a marginalized group, whatever you want to call it. And unless we fully understand these facts and learn to embrace them and really try to figure out a way that we can work to get out of these moments that we've had, we're going to be stuck where we are, people. And that's, you see where we are. It's not a really good place. It's chaos right now. So I think it's important to educate yourself. That's first and foremost the most important thing that I want you to get out of this. So I'll leave this to you so you can make an ultimate decision about what you think is better. But just keep in mind, running away from the truth, hiding yourself away from it, is not going to make it any better. It's not going to make it not exist. So let's embrace what we got. Let's embrace where we come from, the goods and the bads, and see how we can move forward. Today's music is brought to you by none other than Tombstones in Their Eyes with their song, I Can't See the Light. These guys have some classic rock and roll sound, so check them out. You can find them on Spotify. You can find them on Bandcamp, YouTube. Anywhere where you find music, you will find these guys. So check them out. Show your support. See you in 2022. Hey, what is up, guys, and welcome back to another episode of the Social Primate Podcast. Today, my guest is Matt Cedillo. He is a Chicano poet, writer, and author of Mowing Leaves of Grass and his forthcoming book, City on the Second Floor. Hey, what is up, man, and thank you for coming out today.
Thanks for having me. Really excited to be here.
Yeah, thanks, man. I wanted to talk about some of the stuff that's going to be coming for you. I guess you said next year, which will be, you're talking about 2022, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. And that's the release of your City on the Second Floor that you mentioned earlier. Can you give us a little bit of background about what that's going to look like?
Well, you know, City on the Second Floor was a collection of poems. I kind of wrote around the same time as I wrote a lot of the poems from Morning These Grass. But I kind of wanted to have them be a complete thought. You know, of course, you know, I fleshed out the book with more poems and new things and ideas. But, you know, there's some older poems in there that were really kind of, you know, I didn't feel like they fit in Mowing These Grass. I wanted both these books to be kind of complete thoughts, right? So in many ways, if Mowing These Grass is very much my ethnic studies history kind of book, then City on the Second Floor is more of my like kind of Marxist geography kind of sociology kind of book. It's more about the way cities are laid out, how they're kind of built directly against the people that live in them. And so like that's kind of that's what the city on the second floor is about. So the name of the poem, the name of the book takes its title from the Bonaventure Hotel in Los Angeles, which I don't know if anyone's been to, but it actually, Bonaventure connects to like several buildings. There's all these bridges that connect to all these buildings in downtown. And so like there's these bridges from building to building so that you can avoid, you know, being your home.
City traffic. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. A skid row and all that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's like, it's basically this whole, you know, like, so this idea of a city on the second floor, this idea of being able to actually, you know, avoid people because, you know, because they couldn't get into the hotel. So it's can't get into the hotel and can't get into the buildings. And they can't obviously bother you on your way to FedEx or Starbucks or whatever. And so that was kind of like where the inspiration for the title took. I took the inspiration for the title.
Fuck that. Yeah. That in itself is powerful. And you know, once you get the context of it, it just connects, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a pretty brutal thing to see. It's a very brutal reality. And so, yeah, I wanted to write a book that was more like about that. It was more looking at issues, just modern urban life and the way we live today. Whereas More Than This Grass, much more of a history book, much more of a book about like Chicano history specifically, but just, you know, American history more broadly, and about just kind of about these threads and trends. Very much involved in the struggle for ethnic studies, which I've, you know, kind of involved with a number of groups that were pushing for that. So that's kind of you know, in many ways, I was trying to write a book, a poetry book for the ethnic studies struggle. You know. To be kind of like a foundational kind of text within it. That was my goal anyway. So I don't know how successful I've been in that, but that was the goal of Mowing These Grass. See, on the Second Floor is a little bit different, but I think it's going to find its own audience, which can be different. I mean, it's going to be really interesting because I mean, a lot of people that would like See on the Second Floor might not like Mowing These Grass. A lot of people that like Mowing These Grass wouldn't like See on the Second Floor. I don't know, but you know, either way, it's both, but they're different thoughts. I mean, it's a different,
yeah.
It's a different lens, a different focus. And that was really important to me, you know, to have these things that like, one of the biggest things I always think to tell people, you know, you don't have to say everything you think all at once. Mm-hmm. You know, you can, you know, parse your thoughts out, you know, parse your statements out.
Just to kind of jump off one of those points that you made, like you as a writer, how do you pick and choose what the next thing you're going to write about is?
Well, with Mowing These Grass, I knew that it was going to be like, you know, it's going to be mostly like a Chicano studies type book. But I also knew that, in addition to that, I wanted to have a few departures that were just about kind of other stuff. So there's probably like two or three poems that are kind of just general, you know, just general poems, right? And then there's probably about two or three poems in City on the Second Floor that are very Chicano, right? And other ones are just more just general. Because I always want to like, add a little salt, little lime. to cut it a little bit. But for the most part, it should be a certain thing. And so how did I make those distinctions? Well, I mean, I know what I'm writing. I know what I've written. And so there was a body of, there was kind of a core body of poems that were going to go into each collection. And after that, I was like, okay, now I got to write some more, you know, I got to write a few more. And so, you know, basically I kind of like write these poetry collections. They got both of them have 30 poems. And I feel like that's enough. I mean, that's 30 poems. They're $15 each. You know, I don't make these giant books that are unaffordable. And I don't, but I'm also not going to give you 50 poems for $15. Yeah. So like you're going to pay $15 for 30 poems. That's 50 cents a poem. You know, but it's a good deal.
Yeah. It sounds like a bundle. Yeah.
Black Friday deals. Yeah, that's right. But I'm not going to give you like, you know, 50 poems for $15, man. And now you're just being greedy. So that's why. So all my poetry collection is about 30 poems. So that's my mentality. So I'm like, yeah, 30 poems to accomplish this goal. And then I'm going to think about like, okay, so what am I trying to write about here? So then after that one's done, I'm going to have another poetry manuscript working on right now. And I'm like deep into like, I think four different poems right now. And I haven't finished a single one of them, but I know what the theme of the whole book is. So I know what they have to capture. I know what they have to do. And I'm thinking about the other ones. So I actually have 30 poems all mapped out, what they're going to be, how they're going to be. I write in a three act structure. So it's going to start like being act one, this has to happen. Act two, that has to happen. Act three, that's what has to happen. So I already know ahead of time, like what the demands of each poem are and what the demands of each section of the poem should be. But I just have to go do it.
I want to know what triggered you into becoming a writer or to pursuing something like this. Where did that come from? Like,
I mean, I've always kind of written, but what really triggers, I don't think anything ever really triggered me. I mean, I've always been, you know, into writing. I get re-triggered all the time, you know, like, honestly, I mean, like, if you ask me, like, why I do a lot of things I do, I mean, if things are going well, I'm liable to coast. So it's the adversity. It's the pushback. It's the whatever. So I mean, I'm probably driven more. And I have been, you know, ever since I started taking this role seriously. I'm probably driven more by detractors and haters and all kinds like that. People that just don't want to give me credit or don't want to who oppose me for the political reasons or whatever. You know, that's what really drives me much more than people just saying good job. I'm like, good job. This doesn't mean much to me. I appreciate it. I mean, I don't sound like a jerk, but I appreciate it. But it's not like it doesn't compel me to work harder or to go out there and to really start thinking about, okay, what's the next project? Where I'm much more propelled by insult, by challenge, and by whatever. All the compliments and stuff, that stuff makes me want to cry. I'm just starting to, like, you know, fall apart and be like, oh, God. You know, how funny was it get here? You know, it's like all emotional, you know? Like, you know, like, you don't know where I'm sacrificed all. And you know, emotional. In the face of kindness, but in the face of like disrespect, in the face of challenge, in the face of like, who do you think you are? Then that's when I get really motivated. That's when I get really fired up.
I mean, the good thing is you're turning that energy anyway into fuel. Yeah. You know, I can see it. No, that's crazy, man. You know, because I've heard some interviews that you had on what was the channel called? Actually, let me see if I can pull it up because I want to give them a little shout out because I like what they were doing on that. The whole, it's called Anticonquista.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Good stuff. And I kind of want to bring it in a little bit because I've heard what you talk about. And when I think about what you have to say in terms of what the conversation in certain aspects about what critical race theory is, like this conversation gets a little murky, you know?
Yeah. Well, so what I think about the concept of critical race theory is what is called critical race theory. You know, it's very similar to, you know, the question of ethnic studies. I mean, like, the reality about it is that critical race theory is something that's taught in college. It's not taught in, like, kindergarten. It's not taught in whatever. They're using it as a catchphrase to teach kids that, you know, that racism is there and it's bad, right? And so that's kind of that. But even the phrase critical race theory, the phrase ethnic studies, these are all watered down already. And, you know, people are hating and fighting. And, you know, in the case of ethnic studies, when it was first being, you know, brought around, you know, in especially Chicano studies, and people died for this. And people, you know, it was car bombs in, like, Colorado in the 70s. You know, for these people that were advocating for ethnic studies, you know, they had to go on a hunger strike for this in UCLA to get a Chicano studies department. So, I mean, these are things that people have died and suffered, all kinds of things in order to get about. So I don't want to sound like I'm dismissing it, but the names themselves, ethnic studies, critical race theory, these are all watered down ways of saying what we're really talking about. What we're really talking about is white supremacy. What we're really talking about is murder and conquest and slavery and genocide and the foundations of the United States of America. And not only the foundations of the United States of America, the foundations of the modern world. modern world, the world we live in today, is as it is structured still today. I mean, with some exceptions, with the rise of Japan and China in the late 20th century to today, with the exceptions of that, it's really been shaped by the past 500 years of European conquest of the whole world, colonizing the entire world, tearing the resources out of it, and we all kind of taking on this this kind of standard kind of global culture or global kind of economy based upon the domination of a handful of countries that have just ransacking the world, including where we live. They're ransacking the entire world, and we think it's normal. And that's that. And to say maybe it's not normal, or critical race theory and ethnic studies, I don't really think they do a great job of anti-imperialism, to be honest with you. But within the United States, to look at how people who are kind of called racial minorities or whatever suffer disproportionately is an anathema to some people, because they don't want to deal with it. But the reality is this, that the reason why there are people who find themselves at the bottom of the barrel of this country is based in history. It's based in real history. There's a reason why these groups of people, why Native Americans, right, are the poorest people in the country. There's a reason why the so-called Latinos, right, Jamaicanos and Puerto Ricans and Salvadoreños and others, right, are the lowest paid workers in America. There's a reason why they suffer the highest education. There's a reason why the cops are shooting Black people and incarcerating them at the highest rates. And these reasons aren't because of any deficiencies within these groups of people. These reasons are history.
We're talking about
land theft. We're talking about enslavement. We're talking about abduction. We're talking about something that is the very foundations of the modern world economy, which is the conquest of the Western Hemisphere and the transatlantic slave trade. That's how all of this was built. Mm-hmm. And later the colonization of Asia, and later the colonization of Africa, and later the neoliberal colonization of what is called South America today. That is the foundations of the world we live in today. And it's not a science study. It's not an ethnic study. It's not a critical race theory. It's not some like thing that's like some offshoot, some little bubble elsewhere that is like an adjunct to the real history, which is Paul Revere riding on a horse. No, it is the main story. It is the main storyline. It is the primary explanation for why the world is shaped as it is today. So that's what I feel about that. Now, people don't want their children taught that because they don't want to accept that. They don't want to believe that. It's not just white people who don't want it. It's not just white people. It's a lot of people that don't want it, don't want to accept the way the world really is. And it's including people who are victimized in this country, don't want to accept the way the world actually is. So it's a much wider spread problem than the denial that people live in this country. It's a much wider spread problem than we really talk about. And it's much more than white people are not the only people in this country that are in denial. It's sort of really, and I'm not saying this in defense of white people, I'm saying it's in condemnation of virtually everyone.
of course, because at some point, ignorance crosses fucking racial lines,
it's a very, very ignorant country, willfully ignorant country, and a country where you're rewarded to be ignorant, where at least you get a psychological wage from being ignorant. And so that's kind of why people don't want to deal with it. They don't want to deal with the reality of it because it's too brutal, it's too gruesome. The reality is way too gruesome. Some people don't want to deal with it, and the problem with that is that since you don't want to deal with it, you never deal with like the actual ongoing problems. You don't deal with the ongoing manifestations of these things. You don't go over the ongoing process of these things. It's not over. I mean, there's a pretty straight line between all these things that are happening. So, Donald Trump comes down an elevator and says, Mexico, last player says Mexico saying go George Rapist. That there's a straight line between that and then Prop 27. Straight line between that and the book ban in Arizona, straight line between that and SB 1070 in Arizona, straight line between that and the massacre in El Paso, which happened, the straight line between the massacre in El Paso and the massacre in San Ysidro in the '80s, and the massacre, these massacres, these state sanctioned massacres that happened in the Bracero program, where they left people out in the desert to die. And a straight line from there to the Texas Rangers, straight line from the Texas Rangers to the lynchings of the gold rush. I mean, so this is straight from all these things. And so it's not, it's not like, but when the things I'm talking about, the most recent thing I'm talking about happened like 4 or 5 years ago. Or, no, not less than that. Happened like 2 or 3 years ago, right? So the most recent thing I'm talking about 2 or 3 years ago. So I'm not talking about ancient history, but I'm showing you how that history is rooted in a longer history. And that's a longer history that's denied to us, particularly Chicanos, is denied to us. And told us, we're not even told anything about it. We're just down and out because we're Mexicans and that's it. You know, and there's no reason for that. There's no explanation for that. And so that's what the fight for critical race theory, for the critical fight for ethnic studies, that's why we should be involved in it. That's why it's important. My criticisms notwithstanding, that I think it's too watered down, whatever. That's the banner we're fighting under. Fine. That's the banner we're fighting under. We got to fight for it. We got to fight for it because we're fighting for a clear understanding of why we're in the conditions we are today. And once we understand those better, it'll be easier to fight to get better conditions.
I guess, like you mentioned earlier, like it's also getting kind of hijacked, like the terminology of it, because a certain side's trying to use it to say, you know, fear mongering, like, hey, like they're trying to make our people, our kids scared in school, trying to divide them. But that's not the reality of it. Like you mentioned, it's about educating the masses in terms of what's going on. And it's just fucked up. It's sad that we're in this place in 2021 where we're thinking that we're the most progressive, we're the most advanced, you know, humanity has been, and we're still having these conversations where we're trying to ignore reality of what happened.
Yeah.
We're not being progressive like we think we are at all, because they're not teaching you that.
They don't teach you that at all. And so like, I think that's why, you know, and then that's why, you know, it's called Mowing This Grass. For those who don't know, yeah. Lisa Grass is a book written by a guy named Walt Whitman. Walt Whitman's a very famous poet, and he's considered kind of the father of American poetry. Mm-hmm. Someone can say the father of modern poetry, but he was also a real, you know, real big racist, and he was a journalist as well, and he wrote in a paper, you know, what is miserable, inefficient Mexico with the grand mission of people in the new world, the noble race, and so, you know, like that's despicable to me. And then also he wrote even I think it's even in Leaves of Grass, it's a poem called Ode to California, which says, California, I will teach you this robust American love. Now, what does this mean? You're right, this in 1850s, to teach California robust American love. Again, this is a period of time during the gold rush. This is a period of time during the foreign miners tax. This is a period of time during the Greaser Act. This is a time doing this, all these kinds of means to dispossess Mexicanos and indigenous peoples from their land and from their way of life, from their ability to, you know, make a living and make room for you know, settlement from you know, white Americans coming in from the east. And so that is what was happening at the time when Walt Whitman said, California, I will teach this robust American love. So what does that mean? You know what I'm saying? And that's kind of why I wrote a book called Mowing These Grass, because I really despise the fact that some people look up to Walt, so many, and you know that nobody should look up to him, I guess, but like with the fact that so many people who want to be writers, Chicanos, who want to be like writers and want to this, they want to be, you know, they have an artistic flair and they want to write poetry. Walt Whitman is someone they look up to as a giant, you know? And I don't think it's healthy for people to look up to someone who would have looked down upon you. You know, that's not good.
Yeah.
It's not good for you. And so was Walt Whitman talented? Sure, he's very talented. But you know what? I'm talented. Look up to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of, you know, like progressive, I mean, I think that's a big myth of American society, is that it's always been bored. And I think that, like, you know, like that's a big myth. I mean, like, if you look at you know, all my life, I was always told about, like, you know, I mean, I'm born in the 80s, right? So it's not that far removed from the 60s. And I'm always told about how great, you know, the 1960s were. And that's when everything got fixed in America. And, you know, like, you live in a much better country, you know, than your parents did because of all these important things that happened in the 50s and 60s to desegregate the country and, you know, make it a better place. So I'm always like, all my life, I grew up in a period of time where we were saying that, you know, the world is still kind of racist, but it's getting less racist. It was racist, it's getting less racist. It's getting less racist, it's getting less racist, it's getting less racist, it's getting less racist. And Obama gets elected. Oh, okay, look, it's getting less racist, it's getting less racist. And then what happens immediately after? Donald Trump, right? And so this guy is the most virulent racist, you know, in my lifetime. most open racist president in my lifetime. So obviously it doesn't go forward. You know, it slips, it slides, goes back and forth. And you can say that, like, well, what does it matter? Donald Trump's racist. They're all kind of racist. And it was all bad. And, you know, people are poor anyways, and this and that. And you go, okay, but there's still a psychological effect to having some guy on TV saying these horrible racist things. I mean, it's really, there is something that happens to people. And you know, I don't cry for myself so much, but I mean, it's thing about kids, like going to school and being told, you know, we're going to build the wall, we're going to send you back, you know. I mean, imagine growing up to that. I mean, I was a kid, you know, during Prop 27, I remember a lot of that stuff, and that was pretty bad. And Trump's was even much worse. So,
yeah,
you know, like, and so, like, yeah, no, I think that's a big deal. It doesn't matter. And, yeah, so it's obviously we're not marching forward. I mean, it goes forward, it goes backwards, it goes side to side. And,
yeah, I'm sorry.
You know, but it ebbs and it flows, and it spikes, and it goes back, and it retreats. And so I think that in many ways, we got to really understand how that happened, why all that happened, and we have to really understand, like, why was this question of the Mexican border so central to this wave of racist rhetoric? Why was that kind of the centerpiece? Because those things aren't going away. I mean, I think the reason why is because of demographic shift, and demographic shift being, you know, really mostly, you know, driven by growth of the Mexican population.
Yeah, and they're going to be a minority soon.
Right, and so, like, that knowledge is what really is fuming so much of that, and so, like, that understanding that it's not going to go away, and understanding that that's why they felt that way is not going to, because the that reality isn't going to change. Those numbers aren't going to change. Yeah, you know, those numbers aren't going away. So those numbers aren't going away. So the reaction is going to go away. And so really understanding that, but there's very little impetus to examine it that way, because they're gonna frame the question of Donald Trump in any way other than what was most obvious, which is that this guy is talking nonstop about Mexicans. I mean, he talked about a lot of people, did a lot of things, did a lot of bad things, but the most prominent thing that he would always return to was the border wall. So, like, that fact is going to be buried, because his anxiety about this country not being what it was because there's too many Mexicans is not his alone. That's a shared anxiety with a lot of people, a lot of the intelligentsia. And so they're going to avoid that question. You know what I mean? They're going to bury it and pretend it's not happening.
I want to say it was either 2018 or 2019. Trump signed a bill saying that they were going to ban studies, you know, ethnic studies, anything that considered America being like the bad guys, pretty much.
Yeah.
He signed it into law, but I think it wasn't until Biden this year he, you know, took the shit out. But the whole idea is that, again, it's just that back and forth. But again, it was implemented. Even, dude, I was young enough when I was 8 years old in 97, 98. They stopped allowing like kids talk Spanish. Like, there was no more like Spanish in schools and anything. And that was extreme. You know, I saw a lot of people who were my age that were heavily impacted by the fact that they couldn't communicate in their preferred language.
Yeah.
To do something so fucking basic.
Yeah, school's a prison.
That's why I don't know where things are going. And now, like, there's this thing that I saw that you posted on Instagram. Actually, I'm gonna pull it up real quick here. It was some meme that you recently posted. Where is it? Huh? Oh, it says Republicans fuck you, eat shit and die, and Democrats fuck you, eat shit and die, performed by John Legend and Beyonce.
Yeah.
Oh man, because again, it's just a mirage. It's
very much true. I mean, it's very much true. That's all. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen. They're going to play out. They're going to play out. And you know, that it is what it is. The political system is a shell for the economy. The economy is one built on exploitation. So whatever, you know, the puppet show is going to do, it's going to still, the people behind the puppets are still going to do what they're going to do. So that's kind of, you know, where we're at. I mean, it's really a joke, and they got this whole, like, you know, lesser two evil things down pretty good, because, you know, the greater evil is a lot scarier. So I mean, that they've played that round pretty well. You know, like that whole thing where, like, you have a Republican, it's a good cop bad cop thing, right? So, like, the bad cop comes in, he scares the hell out of you, and the good cop returns, and you give the good cop your confession, right? And that's kind of like how the system works. You know, like the scary Republican comes into office, They do a bunch of horrible things, say a bunch of horrible things. You get all riled up. You want to go in the streets. And then, you know, the good cop returns, the Democrats return. And you're like, okay, well, you know, don't go in the streets or else, you know, bad cops can come back, you know? And so, I mean, that's exactly that's how they run it. So that's how the game is played. And normally it's kind of goofy because, like, you know, there's not much difference because they're all trying to like play at the center. Mm-hmm. But this time around, you know, no, there was a big difference, at least in rhetoric, between the two. So this round they played it pretty hard. So
yeah, it gets funny because when I was in school, the only person I remember that was a brown skinned person that I was taught about for just like a week, because it was, I think, his birthday, it was Cesar Chavez. The only person I ever knew that was like, oh, that's the only brown guy, I guess, that exists in history that made any difference in, you know, yeah, that I can feel like I can role model off of. Yeah. And I was watching this video where somebody made this great point where it's similar to like Black history. Like, you learn that there were slaves, that Abraham Lincoln came out. He was like, well, the Civil War happened. Abraham Lincoln signed the Declaration or the Emancipation. Boom. The 60s MLK came out, signed the thing, and now racism is gone. But yeah, again, that's the, there's like that saying, history is written by the winners, you know, the people who fucking win these things.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, history is written by the winners, and they write it. They don't just write it to it's not a victory lap. They write it to keep winning. Do you know what I mean? It's basically the writing of history is them like renewing your terms of surrender. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like they keep writing, they write it and write it and write it away to sand off, you know, the brutal things they've done. Yeah. You know, to come to sand it down and to make it actually palatable, to make things that were to the point where you're raised to believe that people like Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, you know, figures like this, Andrew Jackson, are heroes, are wonderful, are incredible people, you know, mm-hmm. are great people, are people to be admired, are people we should pattern ourselves off of, and not who they were, which is, you know, slave drivers. These people owned other people. These people enslaved people. You know, these people, you know, held them at the point of, you know, with the threat of death.
Yeah, of course.
To sacrifice their entire lives to their comfort. You know, that's what these were. These people were murderers. These people came to, you know, another place, and they found people in their homes, you know, villages and their you know, communities, and they murdered them and they stole land. That's who they were. But we're told that these people were these unique geniuses who came up with some kind of concepts that set humanity free. Because they said what? Because they said, give me liberty or give me death. I mean, that's Patrick Henry. And he too owned slaves. You know what I mean? And so like that's the writing of history is the maintenance of power. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's a way of framing things. The frame of things so that you're sitting here and looking up to these people who, again, would have looked down upon you and would have done a lot more than look down upon you too. So that's kind of, why this is important.
There's a bunch of complexity and like intertwining pieces that go into all of this. And right now that you mentioned that, there's an argument that I was reading that's going around, that saying like, oh, well, what if these guys didn't do all this stuff? What if they hadn't oppressed all these people? Where would we be as a society, as a Western society? So trying to kind of like put less blame on the fact that they exploited all these people because it was for the advancement of our Western civilization. Otherwise, where will we be? That's the counter argument. Like, oh, if they wouldn't have done it, then who else would have done it? And it's like, well,
The question really isn't that. It's like, where would these other places be?
Yeah.
If not for that. I mean, that's the real question.
Yeah.
If these other places weren't getting, like, you know, I mean, we live in a world right now where, let's take the Philippines, right? The Philippines is the world's, I believe, largest, I might have this reversed, but it's one or the other. I think the world's largest importers of rice. And Thailand is the world's largest exporter, right? Mm-hmm. And the reality is that, you know, people in the Philippines have been growing rice, you know, since agricultural revolution took place there. You know, people in Thailand have been growing rice ever since the agricultural revolution took place there. They don't need multinational corporations to come in and feed them rice and teach them how to eat rice. Mexico is the world's second largest importer of corn. You know, people in Mexico have been growing corn ever since, you know, people have been growing any kind of food. Mm-hmm. And they don't need multinational corporations to sell them corn, right? And so that's kind of the world we live in, wherein people's way of lives have been commodified, have been commercialized, but ways of lives that stretch back thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years, you know, tens of thousands of years, you know, ever since people stopped wandering around the desert, you know, ever since people sat down and made cities and farms and villages, right? So that, you know, wherever that is, they find a way that the world system we live under has found a way to make money, to make profit for people in New York, for people in San Francisco, for corporations, you know, located in, you know, the Netherlands or something, off the ways in which people have lived in a place for time immemorial. And that is, and that's the system we live under. So the question really isn't, you know, well, where would we be with that? The question is, you know, where would other places be if they won't be so brutally exploited? How would people be living if they weren't so brutally exploited? Yeah, that's a real question. And you know, where would these people be? They'd still be in Europe. That's where they'd be. If they didn't come and murder everyone, they'd still be in Europe. There would be no America. That's the answer.
It's fuck. It's like, oh, I don't know, man. History is key, man. Like I feel like, you know, when you think about it, take it on a personal level, like when you do some bad shit in your life and you get to a point when you're like growing or walking around with all this remorse or this guilt in you, you finally either learn to accept it or like embrace that the fact that you were a douchebag back in your life, that you did some shitty stuff. And the best thing to do is, again, embrace it, accept it, maybe apologize and be like, hey, man, whoever I did wrong, let me come clean with you. And then at the end of the day, you feel lighter, you feel more grown as a person, matured, and you're able to move forward and make better decisions. Right. And in a sense, that's what America is not doing, you know, and an embodiment is not happening, where it's really taking into consideration everything that it's done and trying to find a way. It's like there's other ways that it's not going about it to really show that it's ready for real growth.
Yeah, well, but America was never... America never stopped being a douchebag. So I mean, it's not like you apologize for your douchebag ways in the past. Ooh. You know, like, oh shit, I can't believe it. Oh man, I was in my 20s. Oh, you know, I was in my 20s. I got too hot too fast. Or something, you know, this is not something like, it's not like that. This America has not stopped. I mean, the United States of America is still a country that, you know, that bombs other countries, still putting sanctions on the country, still it has criminal sanctions against places like Cuba, against places like North Korea, whatever you think of the North Korean government, it's still the sanctions against North Korea are criminal. And so, you know, it's an attempt to starve them. So I mean, like, there's all kinds of horrible things going on. You know, the sanctions against Iran are horrific. The sanctions against Nicaragua are horrific. You know, what this country has done in the last 30 years to Iraq is still no one deals with that. No one's dealt with what we did to Vietnam. And so those recent realities, you know, not going way back, those recent realities are not dealt with in this country. They're not talked about that often. If anything, if you go to like any post office, you can see, or many post offices these days, you'll find a POW/MIA flag. Well, what does that mean? That's talking about, that's a flag to commemorate the, you know, prisoners of war missing in action, principally in Vietnam, right? So this is a flag to commemorate what the Vietnamese did to the Americans, what they did to us. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing that we fly in this country. That kind of, you know, that kind of brutal denial, that kind of disgusting, it's repulsive. And that's the country we live in. And we don't want to deal with it. We don't want to deal with it because it's what our uncles believe. It's what our parents believe. It's whatever, not just white people, man. This is what is ingrained in all of us. And And we don't want to deal with it because it's unpleasant. It's unpleasant. And we don't. And I, you know, and I'm saying we don't. I don't. I mean, I just don't talk about it with my family. Fuck it. I don't care. You know, I'll go on a podcast talk about it, you know. But like, you know, why bother? Why bother? Yeah. You know, whatever. I mean, it's not gonna do anything, it's gonna change anything. And honestly, all these things, like, you know, go talk to your parents about racism, talk to your uncles about it. I mean, you could do that, but don't you'd be a lot better off joining an organization and trying to get something done than randomly talking to your family members about their shitty attitudes about whatever topic. Because honestly, let me say something about your shitty family. I'm not saying your family or anyone here in this family. I'm not the royal shitty family. Let me tell you something about those members of your family were never going to do shit. They weren't going to do anything positive or negative one way or the other to impact the world. They were going to sit around, they were going to live their lives, and they were going to die. And that's it. For the most part, most people don't do anything. So really, that's not good use of your energy. What you should do is join an organization that you believe in, fight for cause, the environment, you know, fight for cause to, you know, fight for critical race theory, fight for ethnic studies, fight, you know, against, you know, workers' rights, the fight for, you know, against some, like, particular, you know, environmental hazardous thing going on in your community. Go do that. That's a much better time than trying to convince, you know, your dad not to be, you know, homophobic or something like that. The better use of your time is to fight for the causes you believe in an organized fashion. And anyone who tells you anything different is just a lazy fucker who likes to sit around judging people at a dinner table. And those are the worst people in the world. Those are the worst fucking people. I can't stand them.
Yeah.
They bother me more than the bigots, to be honest with you. The people that are this hall monitor kind of politics, like, and they think they're actually doing something. You didn't do anything. So, like, you know, go out there and try to make an impact on a much bigger scale than judging the 15 people you know.
You know, and it's a conversation that you hear often, but it's something that you see in social media a lot. You know, it's like, you feel like you share a few posts and you're feeling like you're doing like guerrilla work, you know. It's like, no, you're sure a few people are seeing it, but a lot of the times people are just going to skip it, you know. Like, people don't really care, you know. It's like, just face it, they're not really looking at what you're saying unless you mean something to that person.
Right. And that's another thing. Yeah, stop worrying about being like canceled or something like that. Because honestly, like, I've been canceled like 7 times. Nothing ever happened. Like, you know, you gotta really like it. All cancellations are self cancellations. Mm-hmm. Well, you really, you know, the reality is that nobody gives a fuck about you. Nobody cares. Like, nobody really cares. Anyone that went to attacking you, they don't even care. Even as they're attacking you, they don't care. You stand in as like a stereotype. You stand in as like a type in their mind, is a kind of icon, right? And you stand at this moment as that thing. You are that thing. And now it's time to judge that thing. They don't know you personally. They don't care about you personally. Yeah. And in 3 or 4 days, you can forget about it and move on to somebody else. So even if that happens to you, which just happens less and less and less anyways online, but that, even if that happens to you, it really doesn't matter. Just keep doing what you're doing and it'll be over. I mean, because the reality is, I mean, unless you've done something horrible, man, if there's nothing there, if you've done something horrible, then, you know, well, then you're fucked. But, like, and maybe you deserve it. But, like, if you haven't done anything, like, if it's a stretch and people are just, like, just, you know, if they're just, like, yapping a yap, then don't worry about it. But don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. People are way too worried about that stuff. And if you're doing that kind of stuff, that's not politics, man. That's not politics. You know, going around pointing the finger at people is not politics. So, yeah. Anyways,
no, I completely agree with you. It's just, it's easy. It's, you know, like right now, I can, if I wanted to, I'd be like, "Hey, man, start talking smack, and what are you gonna do? You can't do nothing across the street." Break your computer. Yeah, you know, it's like, you can't do shit. So of course you're gonna get this fucking level of confidence to just talk smack and disagree with somebody immediately. You know. Like,
but on the other hand, you're out there talking like real reckless, man. Remember, the internet is a digital place, but it's also a real place. And then you know, you say some things online, people will see you in person. I mean,
oh, yeah, no, if somebody wants to find you, they're gonna find you. Like,
So, like, don't think they're just because you're comfortable around your keyboard,
yeah, just, or change your IP address too, you know, start with that.
Just because you're comfortable on a very keyboard does not mean you're going to be comfortable on the sidewalk. You know what I mean? When it happens. So, you know, be mindful. Be mindful of what you're saying.
Yeah, no, of course. No, man, I really enjoy the conversation because, again, I guess what I just want people to take out of this is what I want people to always take out of these conversations is to just like take the information and consume it and look for it on your own as well. Like, you know, pick up somebody's book, pick up your book, you know, read a little bit, you know, fucking just broaden your horizon, you know, and just, I don't know, man, it's weird that a lot of us are still opposed to that. Like you said, it's about the comfort. You know, people feel uncomfortable with things that are challenging what they know, with the way of life, with their lifestyle, with their ideologies. And it feels like you're in panic mode. You know, I've mentioned this before many times in the podcast. And unless we educate ourselves and we understand that, and I like how you said that America is still the douchebag because, it is. It's still the bro. Like, hey, fuck you. It doesn't care. Hopefully, we can change it though.
Yeah, sure.
And like, so we all want.
You changed. But I just think that people need to. I mean, like, you know, like you question like why you believe what you believe, and you need to be able to rationally explain it. And if you can't, then maybe you need to believe something else. I mean, you need to be like open to changing kind of how you see things, and you know, kind of question like what is the origin of my thoughts? Like, where do these thoughts come from? How did I reach this conclusion? And not just be so like proud and egotistical that you're just completely devoted to those conclusions. And don't get so hung up on labels, man. Don't be like, I'm a this, I'm a that. I'm a communist, I'm a this, I'm a, you know, I'm a Marxist Leninist, I'm a Trotsky. Don't get so hung up on labels. Like really try and look at the world in front of you and try and figure out what it is you're looking at. And then explain it in your own language, in your own terms, your own brain. You know, it's cool to be influenced by people, but like getting so hung up on all these kinds of different like theories and well, this person said and that person said, I don't give up what they said. I mean, like, what are you saying? So, you know, you gotta stop. I guess I'm getting to a different topic now, but you gotta stop like idolizing people. You gotta stop like thinking that these are people that you can't be. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it's good to look up to people. It's good to admire people. It's good to pattern yourself off of people who've done things that you would like to do. But you got to stop thinking that, like, you know, you don't have a mind and you don't have a brain. You can't also have, like, great indelible thoughts. You can't have immortal thoughts. You can't, like, come up with things that, like, holy crap, that's, like, incredible and blah, blah, blah. You know, like, I guess for me it comes easy because, you know, I'm a writer, so, like, I write things all the time. And sometimes I write things, I'm like, holy shit, I can't believe no one's ever said that. Or at least no one has ever said that in a prominent kind of way. Like, I have this poem working right now. It says, you know, if anyone made fun of them or told them to go back to where they came from, well, then they had their mother's permission to send those devils back to hell. And I had never heard anyone say, send those devils back to hell. And that's so obvious. That's such an obvious thing to say. Send those devils back to hell. But I've never heard anyone say that in a poem. I've never heard anyone say that in a song. And I'm like, oh, shit, I got to it, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, so like to me, that's the best kind of writing. You can have like writing, it seems like nobody wrote it. That seems like it's like a mountain, like it's always been there. You know, things like every breath you take or something like that. You know, like that's so simple, but it's like perfect. And nobody else has said it before, you know, before what the band, the Police or something like that. You know, like when you have like these really simple, like, ain't no sunshine when she's gone. You're like, oh, you know, damn, lean on me, you know, like, Bill Wilson. Yeah. Like coming up with these like little iconic lines. They're just like so obvious, but you were the first to get there. To me, that's like the best. But they're immortal. They stand the test of time, and you too can write lines that stand the test of time. And you too can come up with ideas that are indelible. And you too can understand the world in a new kind of way and express it in a new kind of way that'll make people like really just be shocked and it'll be as brilliant as a thought as anyone ever had. Yeah, you can do that. Why not? You know, you gotta stop in crystallizing people and putting them in, you know, making statues of them, you know, marbleizing them. You know, that's not the way it is. This whole thing with humanity, generation to generation, it's been a long conversation.
Wise words from Matt Cedillo. Damn, man. This is gonna be some profit stuff. Watch. This is gonna be people are gonna listen to this episode and they're gonna be like they're like, fuck. Nah, man. I really enjoy this. I again, this helps me digest ideas too, and it makes me again make my own conclusions. You know, you could have an original thought, like you don't have to fucking follow somebody all the time. And yeah, I mean that's what it is. You know, don't people just get hung up on the fact that people have this base? At least, again, going back to the whole social media, people see that you have 10,000 followers, 10 million followers, and they assume that what you say is got, you know, God's word. It's like, nah, chill. You know, calm down. That's just one person that just happens to have a fucking algorithm point you to this direction. But again, people can be influential, but we need to know when to pull back and just fucking be an individual.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Yeah. I mean, if people want to find your book, if for the book that's also going to be coming out, like where can people find that?
Just look up on, you can just Google it. Mowing These Grass, and it'll show up. It's being sold by Amazon. It's being sold by Barnes & Noble. It's being sold by Walmart. It's being sold by all kinds of people.
Yeah, sick.
But you know what? The Waltons don't need more money, and Jeff Bezos doesn't need more money, and Barnes doesn't need any more money. No, neither does Noble. So if you can find my publisher, buy it from them. Flower Song Books. So if you can find flowersongbooks.com, and you find my book there, so you buy direct. But if not, if that's too much of an hassle, then just get it off Amazon or I think Target has it too.
Ah, okay. No, nice. Options. People have options. There's no like I can't find the book. No, you'll find it.
Absolutely. When you're big time, you know, you get.
That's fine. All right. Well, man, thank you again for making the time to come out. It was a pleasure. No, of course. And then, you know, this is going to be one of the last episodes for this year. So, dude, thank you again for taking the time, and hope it's not the last time we have a conversation.
Yeah, we'll talk again soon.
All right, man. Take it easy. Have a good night.